Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Mexican-American relationship has been much in the news recently, mostly via discussion of illegal aliens, of the building of vast and expensive walls, of instant deportations, of dreamers being abruptly woken up. But what stories are not being told, either enough or at all? In 2014, an unprecedented rise in the number of unaccompanied and undocumented Mexican and Central American children arriving at the US border resulted in draconian new policies. This, in turn, drove the Mexican-born New York-based writer Valeria Luiselli, herself an alien at the time, anxiously awaiting an elusive green card, to take on the role of interpreter and translator, helping to steer the children through the immigration courts. Tell Me How It Ends, an essay in 40 questions, is the result, a meditation structured around the 40 questions asked to the children by lawyers building their case. And the answers spell the difference between being allowed to stay, and if so, on what terms, or being turned away. Luiselli came into the studio to discuss the ongoing crisis, America's role in it, and where she positions herself as a writer. If you've heard this interview before on Freedom Books, Flowers in the Moon, you can skip along 20 minutes and you'll pick up with the rest of the podcast.
I first heard about the crisis in 2014 and I wrote this book about a year later. I wrote it as a result of 1 year, basically, or a bit more than 1 year working in court as an interpreter, translator, screener for children. There was a huge need at that time for people who could translate between English and Spanish, Spanish and English, because as you may know, in the US, everyone speaks Spanish except lawyers and maybe editors. So they're two very monolingual worlds. And so I was among the many, many volunteers that arrived in those months to listen to kids' stories and translate them into English and write them down in order to have something to start with and hopefully find a pro bono lawyer for that child.
How did you, you have a very specific role in all of this. How did you understand your role as a translator and an interpreter, the two things not being the same thing? How did you find, what did you find that you were doing? What was your role? And perhaps you could talk a bit about the importance of language, because you set it very much, the problem, as being one about reframing things with the language that you use.
I mean, court interpreting is an art on its own, and I had no previous formal training as a court interpreter or as a simultaneous interpreter. It really is a very difficult thing to do. And I did have some basic training in translation, but it's also not my area, you know? So I had to learn quickly and a lot. But I think what was clear from the beginning is that there was an overlap of several forms of translation. So there was, first of all, the very literal sense of carrying over what children said in Spanish into English. But then there was also a kind of translation from an adult language, a bureaucratic language, to the language that a child might understand. So often some of the questions in the questionnaire are incomprehensible for a child, such as, did anyone in your former country need and have access to mental health insurance? There's no way to have a conversation. And the point of the interview with an intake interview with a child in court is to really get as much information from a child so that a case can be built, and with that case, a pro bono lawyer found. So it makes no sense to try to follow this very sort of bureaucratic, brutal language. So there's a level of interpreting there, interpreting and translating and rephrasing. And then there's other very just fine layers, complex threads that have to do with sort of cultural translation, if I may say it like that. For example, I'm a Chilanga, which means I'm from Mexico City. A lot of the kids that I interview are catrachos, which means they're from Honduras. And Hondurans are not very fond of Mexicans, and for a good reason, because Mexico is a country that has always treated Hondurans with great cruelty, and much more so in recent immigration waves. A lot of people get killed, disappeared. So there's a kind of difficult negotiation in the terms that I use when I interview a child from Honduras. And I remember one of the first kids I interviewed, and he's someone I talk about in the book. He said, "What are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm not a gringa." And he said, "So what are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm a chilanga." And he said, "Well, I'm a catracho, which means we're enemies." And I said, "Well, yeah, but we're only enemies in football, and I suck at it, so you've already scored 5 goals against me, so let's get on with this," right? And he kind of smiled, and he almost laughed, and I didn't gain his trust, but maybe I did at least get his attention. Mm. And he was a teenager, so it was a more difficult kind of interaction. So the whole time I had to negotiate with these very invisible threads that bind us and also separate us, right?
This is Manuel you're talking about, I think. Yes. You describe his story as obsessing you through the book, and I guess that's because he, perhaps more than any of the others, really brings home the extent to which the US is implicated in all of this, how symbiotic the relationship is there. Perhaps you could tell us a bit about that, his particular story.
Yes, exactly. That's a really good way of putting it. So Manuel, whose story I tell in great detail in the book, and who is a person that I'm still in contact with him and his whole family, and partly for bad reasons, basically because his case is ongoing, and although he now has some form of immigration relief, he doesn't have a green card, and it's not clear if he will ever. But he arrived in 2014, and I interviewed him in court in his first notice to appear in the early months of 2015. So I was his first kind of court screener, right? And he was my first case. He had been basically persecuted by gangs in his home country, in Honduras. He refused to join a gang, despite the great pressure that was put on him. He actually went to the police at some point and filed a report, and nothing was done. And one day he was just getting out of school with his best friend, and he noticed that boys from that gang, not only boys, but sort of older men too from that gang, were waiting for him outside the school, and that there were many, so that there was no chance in fighting them. So he left walking, pretending not to notice, not to see, just not acknowledging their presence. And they started walking after him and his friend. At some point, they took out guns. So Manu and his friend started running, and the gang members shot Manu's best friend right there in front of him as they tried to run away. You know, shot him in the back, and Manu kept on running. He kept on running, and he eventually made it home and safe. And he called that night. He called an aunt that he has in Long Island, who had migrated years earlier, and told her the story, and she said, "Don't worry, I understand this is that your life is at risk. I'm going to get you over here, whatever that costs me." And she did. She paid a coyote to get him over to the U.S. Coyote being a people smuggler, basically, someone who crosses children or adults across national borders. So a coyote took Manu over to the U.S. And Manu turned himself in at the border. The coyote didn't cross the deserts with him. He just deposited Manu at the U.S. border. And Manu, as most kids, looked for border patrol to turn himself in as soon as possible. Often kids, by the way, would tell me in court that the worst would be not to find a policeman, like to get to the desert and then just be in the middle of the desert with no one there, so deposited by a coyote and no policeman in sight. So children usually in groups or sometimes alone walk through the most transited highways and roads, just waiting for a, a, policemen and border patrol to appear.
Because in effect, until you exist in the system, you don't exist at all.
Right, right. I mean, not only is crossing the desert, if you're a child on your own, practically impossible, but if you do cross it and actually survive and manage to get to the first town and arrive to a point where there's water and food, you'll be a ghost, basically, because no one caught you, and so you're not in the system, and then your destiny is to remain undocumented for the rest of your life. And that's not what these children want, and that's not what international law dictates, by the way. No? These children, because of the situation, they're fleeing, like Manu, fleeing a systematic persecution, not of a government, but of a kind of parastate, which is what gangs have become, right? They have a justice system, they traffic arms, they traffic drugs, they almost have their own currency. I mean, they don't, but they are like a parallel economy and a parallel government. So international laws that protect refugees, if someone is persecuted by a group, a political group, or a government for certain kind of reasons, there's four or five very clear categories of what makes you eligible for asylum. But if you're running, if you're being persecuted for any one of those reasons, you are eligible for asylum. So these kids are, by international standards. They just need to find a lawyer to make their case. So when Manu arrived finally in the U.S. safe, he received this notice to appear. I interviewed him in court. And while I was interviewing him, he took out a piece of paper that was this report, report that he'd filed in the police denouncing the fact that there was this group of men, young men, boys, and older men from a gang that had constantly harassing him. And when I saw that, although I'm not a lawyer, I thought, well, maybe, you know, this looks like some kind of evidence, so let's ask. And I called over the lawyer that had given me the basic training to start interviewing the kids, and she said, that's it. You don't have to even continue with the interview. This gives us a really solid case. And so Manu luckily received, immediately, he got really great pro bono lawyers, basically like huge firm that does some pro bono work, who took on his case, because it was a kind of easy case, you know, and a case that would be won. And they did win the case in some ways. He has a type of protection right now called the SIJ visa. It's a special immigrant juvenile status. But what happened beyond the court is that when Manu started going to school, he started being bullied by gangs in his school in Long Island.
Ones that he recognized, ones that effectively connected right back to where he'd come from.
Exactly. There was the MS-13, which had been present in Honduras and he'd been fleeing, and there was Barrio 18, another gang that he'd been fleeing. So he did not know, but it turned out that in Hempstead, Long Island, there were exactly the same gangs that he was trying to flee from in Honduras. So this realization, a lot of kids don't know when they arrive to the U.S. that maybe they're trapped in a kind of nightmare that they cannot wake up from, right? Because the gangs are not—they're not a couple of drug dealers standing in a corner. They're really like, I was talking about kind of parastates, but they're like transnational parastates. They have an immense power. I mean, no one really knows, but the MS-13. Has maybe more than 60,000 members, and these, you know, these are people with guns, people with a kind of fearless and no fearless attitude to life, but also no respect for life, right? So that's what the U.S. often does not acknowledge.
And how much do you think that there's been a growing awareness, or in fact the opposite, in terms of the general public? I know, of course, that your book is being has been billed as, you know, the first book to read for the Trump era, but you know, it predates that, because in fact when you start writing, it's about policies that came into effect during the Obama administration. So where are we now? What's the climate? What's changed since President Trump came into power?
I mean, everything is worse, but of course all these policies started long before Trump existed. I mean, everyone has been somehow complicit, and the Democrats have not been better, at least for immigrant lives, right? there's maybe more education on the matter now because more people are writing about it in spaces that are more visible, perhaps. So it's, there's more awareness that, that this particular immigration crisis is not really an immigration crisis, but a refugee crisis, and that the United States is implicated in it historically. I go into why that is in the book, reasons of its implication, and also in the shared responsibility of the governments of the USA, Mexico, and the Northern Triangle. And I argue in the book that until all our governments acknowledge their shared responsibility, there will be no solution either for transnational gangs or their victims, which are children most of the time, children and minors. The Trump situation is not going to make any of this better because, I mean, the way that he and the White House manipulate information is, I mean, I don't even have to go into that, but for example, Trump was in Long Island a few months ago, and he spoke of the gangs there, the MS-13 and so on, in complete false terms. He said what he usually said: these gangs are pouring into the U.S. from the U.S.-Mexico border, and that's why we need a wall and we have to stop these gangs from coming in. Those gangs were born in L.A., not in Central America. They're not a local problem that is being exported or imported into the U.S. The MS-13 was an L.A. Mm. L.A. gang, as well as Barrio 18. Many people don't know that, and it's easy to manipulate and hide that fact.
Yeah, and it's such a central part of the story that you can't ignore that detail. I mean, I suppose it's interesting in that respect as well that I saw that refugee admission has now been capped at an all-time low.
Absolutely, that's what happened now. I mean, I was talking about Manu's particular case earlier, the fact that the last time I spoke to his lawyers, which was not even a week ago, to ask them what the updates were for his renewal of his current immigration status and for his green card, which he applied for more than a year ago. And the answer was the green card is, there's a big backlog and they won't come until further notice, because the answer was there are no more green cards for Central American children that are trying to get an adjustment of status from a refugee status to a resident status. Just, there's simply no more. The latest update from the White House nightmare is that the government wants to, among other things, deport children as soon as they arrive at the Mexico-US border, regardless of their nationality, and not give them due process, not allow them to go through legal proceedings, as is, by the way, what is constitutional and what international and national law dictates. So, I mean, I don't think this will happen, or not immediately, because it would be illegal. But the law has been changed before. That law used to include children from all over the world, and Bush changed it in 2007 to exclude from it children from Mexico and Canada, really de facto.
Countries that share borders with the US.
Exactly. So de jure, Mexico and Canada, but de facto only Mexico. So it's been done before, and they can find a way, and they will certainly find a way to try to exclude children from Central America. But it won't be immediate, because it's, a lot of lawyers working that have been working on this for a long time, I hope, will find ways to protect as many children, that, especially the ones that are already there and are in an immigration limbo, right?
Like Manu, yeah.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Let's talk about this book in the kind of the broader context of your work, because this is the first book of essays. Or, I mean, it's a book length essay, but it's the first essay based book since Papeles Falsos, which was in 2011. Was that, I think that was translated as Sidewalks in
correct,
the UK.
Correct.
There's a shift in tone from that. Obviously, that first work was more meandering, whereas this one is urgent. It's a very different beast. You say at one point, in Tell Me How It Ends, you say, I knew that if I did not write this particular story, it would not have made sense to return to writing anything else. And that comes in a section called Community. I'm wondering, do you feel yourself becoming increasingly committed, involved as a writer?
I feel myself increasingly involved as a member of a community. And I don't think that it is a writer's duty to anything. I think it is a writer's duty to write well. But as a person, as a human being, as a member of a community, I feel entirely responsible for playing my part. And I think that we are living in times that demand of all of us a different kind of social participation. We're simply not living in the same times that we were even a few months ago. Something changed in the world, and it's urgent that we are present and awake and alive and channeling our energies to things where not that our participation will produce deep and lasting changes, but we have to keep it together as much as possible. And if we have, or that's how I think of it at least, if we have privileged spaces such as newspaper columns or radio shows or books that we publish or whatever else, then great, let's use those spaces to revise the language that is being used around immigration, for example, to denounce atrocities, to keep pressuring, to keep watching. I mean, I think that one of the reasons, for example, that it got so out of hand in 2015, and the Obama administration was able to do such horrible things, such as the creation of the priority docket, was that there wasn't really an international vigilance on all of this. This issue didn't really get coverage outside the U.S., and it didn't get enough coverage in the U.S. either. Very few people. I mean, I think probably The Guardian did something, but it was very, like, everything that was published abroad was very, very scarce. And that, I think, does make a difference when the international community is there and is watching. Atrocities at least do not go by immune.
Yeah. I've said there's a bit, you've said elsewhere that you feel particularly foreign in Mexico. And it's the one place where I don't feel I should be foreign, you say, which brings to mind an expression that you use a couple of times in Tell Me How It Ends, where you talk about the US, the US's great theatre of belonging. I'm wondering what you mean by that.
Well, there's a narrative, right, in the US. There's a narrative about arriving and staying and belonging to that great American dream, so to speak. There's a narrative that doesn't exist in other places, that is not part of the foundational myth of other places as it is in the US, right? So people often will prefer to live in poverty or live in a situation of constant targeting, of being targeted racially or for their religion, just to remain in the United States, right? Because that is the dream. That is what people set out to accomplish, as if living in a place were an accomplishment. In a way, it is. I mean, it is an accomplishment to survive to the brutality of American cities and the the amount of work that people have to get done in order to just pay their rent. There is an accomplishment in that, of course. But I wonder about it in the book, how much will everyone have to endure before it becomes unbearable. I speak to a lot of Mexicans who are undocumented, and a lot of them say that they're thinking of returning to Mexico because this is simply just not bearable anymore. I think that when I wrote those lines, we didn't know how unbearable it was going to get so quickly for so many people, especially people that are undocumented, because they are living under a fascist kind of threat. People cannot sleep at night without knowing, or people cannot sleep at night properly because there is this threat of ICE agents who now are just sort of raiding. They just arrive at people's houses in the middle of the night and knock on the doors and take people away. People that haven't committed crimes, people that they have on their list and decide to disappear, deport back, put into centers, detention center, put into jail. So there is now this brutality that didn't exist in the Obama era, although there were a lot of deportations. There wasn't this feeling that that ICE agents could just come in and take you away. Mm-hmm. So it has become unbearable for many people.
And the personal element for you as well is of course crucial. You were born in Mexico. You live in the US, and there's an anecdote that you tell in the book. It's a sort of coda to this book, where you talk about your daughter in the 2016 presidential campaign, and she's painting her face. Mm-hmm. If you could tell us that story, because that really.
Yeah, I can tell you a bit about that. I mean, I think our situation, I wouldn't say it's great, because just being Mexican in the US right now, it feels like a daily humiliation. But of course, I mean, we're in a situation that's much more comfortable because we have green cards. Not that green cards are a very strong document right now. No? We heard during the Muslim bans of so many people coming from the countries included in the ban, but with green cards that were being just held illegally, basically, because there was no reason to hold them. So everything has become fragile. But before it became fragile, I think that a lot of us sensed that it would or that it could. And my daughter, in the period in which Trump was still running, was still during the primaries, if I remember correctly, when it still wasn't clear whether it would be Hillary or him to run for president, although everyone thought it would be, of course, Hillary. And so she jokingly, and not in her 7-year-old mind, I don't know really what goes on there, but one day she was playing with face paint, and she was painting her face yellow and then blue and then green and then polka dots. And at one point she started painting herself with only white paint, and she said, look, Mama. Look, Mama, I'm painting my face like this so that when Trump comes, you know. Didn't even finish the sentence, but it was...
Didn't need to.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, among kids my daughter's age, I've heard the things that I think are the most heartbreaking. Now, it's not the adults around me that I hear that... I mean, we were maybe prepared in a way, or maybe we're less prepared. And I think what's brutal is to see children being so prepared somehow. So even if they're just playing, right? I mean, there was one occasion of my daughter. There was another occasion which, at the dinner table, my daughter said to us, "Well, maybe we should just not speak Spanish outside, you know, so that they don't know we're Mexican." Or she'll be speaking to a friend. She has one friend called Ella. Who's half Argentinian, half American. She's African American, and Ella told my Ella's a little bit younger, you know. So she told my, you know, you're gonna have to leave America because you're Mexican, and then we're gonna leave too because we're black. So if not, they're gonna kill you, and then they're gonna kill us. With this like matter of factness, like not even fear. There wasn't like self pity or fear and all of that, and I hear children, and I wonder if we should hear them like oracles, if we're really gonna get all the way there. And it's, even if we don't, it's brutal to see kids so kind of mentally prepared for the worst.
And do you feel, given the urgency, the specific urgencies of the time, do you feel yourself drawn more to fiction or to non-fiction, or do you hold them both in equal regard?
I hold them both in equal regard. I don't really make the distinction. The only distinction I'd make is between good books and bad books.
I suppose thinking about The Story of My Teeth, your novel, your previous novel, even that, I mean, it's a work of fiction, but it was very much grounded in fact. The process of gathering real people's stories, and really, I suppose, what comes to the fore in both your fiction and non-fiction, if we'll keep that distinction for a second, is just the work of collaboration, interpretation, in the making of stories.
Yeah, definitely. Probably in its procedure, The Story of My Teeth was more like writing non-fiction, right? Mm. As you have very eloquently put it. I just finished a long, long novel that I started in 2014 during the trip that I talk about in the book. And it's a novel that does talk about immigration, but that does so from a kind of more slanted angle, right? Actually, I was writing the book when I started working in court, and somehow I started using that book, the novel, as a kind of vessel in which to pour in all my sense of rage and desperation and anger. And of course, what happened is that the novel became a little bit pamphletary, not great. It was starting to kind of fall apart, really.
Mm-hmm.
Fiction always needs a kind of nuance. Rage is okay for fiction, but trying to turn a novel into a political instrument is a very bad idea. It becomes kind of like a preaching device, and so I had to stop, and I wrote this piece where I was able to articulate all of this in a much more direct way, which was the way this had to be told. Really, it's more of a way of denouncing a situation than anything. And once I did finish this essay, Tell Me How It Ends, I was able to return to the novel and think about migration, but in a much wider context, and maybe thread more nuance into it, which is what I try to look for in fiction. So I try to write fiction that's like that too, right?
Thank you very much. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
Huge pleasure. Thank you very much.